My friend Stephanie.
revolution. We've suffered through and lived among. Father, free us, intervene and lift the curse. Drench this tainted planet so our handicap can be reversed. Now below the bow we hear the panicked cries of dying men. Thrashing in the water, it's cutting off their oxygen. But we are spared and providence will clearly show. All the meek inherit is the doom of their genetic code. The finger pointing came from God, finding his creation flawed. He decreed a final solution. Off you go, take a plunge. All of you have been expunged in the service of evolution. Our flagship embarks to populate a world with perfect genes. Where no one's new one, three standard deviations from the mean. Mother Nature's second chance. It won't be long before the dove returns the olive branch. As for the dead, they only got what they deserved. It's all too obvious that God is grading on a curve. In his new kingdom, there isn't any simple niche. We won't need janitors or Cretan drones to dig a ditch. We chosen girl will sail ahead until we find the true potential in a cultivated human mind. An unencumbered tribe are we, devoid of mediocrity. Every blemish mended. All of us rejoice in some, are plotting to become a little smarter than the Lord intended. Our flagship embarks to populate a world with perfect genes. Where now was new work, three standard deviations from the mean.
Right now, this really is the beginning of the Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, June 9, 2014. Brought to you by way of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We broadcast on 101.3 on the FM dial. We also have our free online streaming service at freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org on your computer device there, if you're not already listening to it. Otherwise, greetings to you onliners and greetings to all you Santa Cruzians out there who are listening to me this afternoon. It is 3:12 p.m. this June 9th, 2014. If that jives with your own personal time-space continuum, then you know the show is live and you may call in at any time. Area code 831-427-3772. Once again, the line direct to me alone here in the studio is area 831-427-3772. what is Mideast Migraine is all about? Well, as you may partially surmise from the title, it is my rendition of pertinent current facts and opinions about the Israeli-Palestinian debacle that's been going on now for some, oh goodness, 66 years. 66 years in April, as it's celebrated on the current calendar, but of course the pronunciation of the modern state of Israel occurred on May 14th, 1948. The calendar has shifted slightly since then. I, however, am not an Israeli. In fact, I'm a Palestinian American. My father, a Christian Palestinian Arab, was born and raised with pretty much with the rest of his siblings, a great number of them, in Jerusalem, Palestine. He was born in 1915, which means that the area that is very broadly regarded as Palestine today, or historic Palestine, by many as historic Israel, or the land of the ancient Israelites, was under Turkish occupation. And when I say Turkish, I'm referring to under the heel of the Ottoman Empire, under which the Arabs in Palestine lived and suffered under such empirical or empirish occupation for some 400 years. And then the Ottomans, who sided with Germany and the Austro-Hungarians in the First World War, having lost that war, had to give it up. They had to give up Palestine as well as other portions of the Middle East, which eventually became known and established as nations with names such as Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Jordan, or the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. And all except Palestine there, in terms of those countries that were under Ottoman rule. The attempt to establish a Palestinian state encompassing the great majority of their peoples being Arabs, primarily Islamic or Muslim Arabs, and a great many Christians as well as a smattering of other faiths and derivations. The attempt to establish that Palestinian state was frustrated many times on many counts. In particular note, the period from 1936 to 1939, when the Palestinian Arab Revolt occurred, which, although it lasted some 3 years, was eventually crushed. The revolt was crushed by the then imperialistic European occupiers of Great Britain. France also occupied portions of the Eastern Mediterranean there. France held on to what became Syria and Lebanon, and Great Britain, what became Iraq and Jordan, at the time referred to the combination of the country, current-day country of Jordan and current Israel, and the territories which Israel illegally occupies now. Those are all British-controlled. Okay, so what are we doing here? We've got a situation where, as I said, my father was born in 1915, which was still towards the beginning of the First World War. And so he, in his most nascent years, grew up in transition from Turkish rule or Ottoman rule to British Empire rule. Great Britain, control of Palestine. And there had been brewing since well before World War I, going back a couple of decades anyway, a movement to establish a national homeland for the Jewish people. Now, this was well before the terrible Holocaust, which occurred at the hands of the Nazi regime in Germany during World War II. This was well before that Holocaust. But there were pogroms or expulsions and killings of Jews in Russia and some other countries as well during the 1800s. This contributed to the attention given to a movement whose father was primarily Mr. Theodor Herzl. And he got together, he convened this great conference in Switzerland in 1893, I believe it was. I really do need to brush up on my Herzlian history here. But in the 1890s, this guy, Mr. Herzl, a European Jew, put together, I think he was from Switzerland, in fact, Herzl, H-E-R-Z-L, put together a conference with many like-minded Jewish people to talk about what they needed to do to establish a national homeland. And they, of course, were focusing on the historical homeland of the ancient Jews, Palestine. Also referred to in Holy Scripture, both Christian and Jewish, as Canaan, the land of the Philistines, is sometimes referred to as the Levant or the Levantine portion of the Arab world in the Middle East. But I don't really want to get into ancient history now. The point is, the focus was on Palestine and the Jews who developed this philosophy, which they called Zionism, again, the effort to reestablish a national home for present-day Jewish people, well, more than 2,000 years after the ancient Israelites, basically. Well, we'll say about 2,000 years after the Israelites pretty much dispersed and left that hunk of land anyway. They wanted to reestablish it, and they paid minimal attention. They paid some attention. They certainly recognized this as a possible problem in their efforts, but they paid some attention to the fact that there were some people living there who were not Jewish. They were Arabs. They spoke the Arabic language. And they were, for all intents and purposes, in practical consideration, the indigenous people, the natives of Palestine, as they had lived there consistently as Arabs for at least 1,400 years, 1,300 to 1,400 years. Now, this dates back roughly to the beginnings of Islam and the time of Muhammad, the founder of the Muslim faith. Islam. And without getting too carried away with the introduction, I do feel it necessary in my assumption that there are first-time people tuning into the program. This is where I'm coming from. I, as a Palestinian Arab American, I would like to do my part in straightening out a lot of the misconceptions, confusions, and in many cases, many, many cases, outright lies that perpetuate confusion about the situation, about what Israel really is, what it stands for, who the Palestinians really are. And, of course, if anyone wants to talk about that personally to me, just give me a call at area code 831-427-3772. 427-3772. After some two years of doing this program, I think I'm finally starting to memorize the phone number here instead of just reading it off the paper. And this is the Mideast Migraine Show, brought to you by way of Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM, streaming live on our online radio service at freakradio.org. Freakradio.org. Make sure you click on the red oval if you want to tune in using your internet computer there, your PC or device. Click on the red oval that you see when you scroll down to the bottom half of our main page at freakradio.org, and that will hook you up, at least initially, to the streaming service. Please keep in mind that you may need, in fact, you will need If it's not already installed on your device or your PC, you will need a program such as iTunes, Winamp, Windows Player, or a Real Player, Real Player Cloud, in order to make that connection work. So you do what you need to tune that sucker in there. All right. Let us begin the meat of this broadcast, and it's now 3:23. I think I'll begin most or all future Monday programs with an update on the BDS situation. What is BDS? Boycott, divestment, and sanctions, as they apply to Israel, specifically to boycotting Israeli academic and cultural events and aspects of Israeli life in order to draw attention to the fact that they are not affording the Arabs under their military occupation. They're not affording the Arabs under Israeli occupation in the West Bank and effectively in occupation or economic siege in the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, and the Syrian Arabs in the Golan Heights, which Israel continues to hold on to stubbornly in the face of world sanctions against their doing so. The same thing with the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. How many of you out there are aware of the fact that U.S. government policy still maintains officially, this is still on the books, and we're not just talking about the fact that Israel hangs on to the captured eastern half of Jerusalem. We, the U.S. government, we in the U.S., by presumption, their follow-up, do not recognize Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel. Of course, Israeli governmental functions, primarily the seat of the prime minister, who is Benjamin Netanyahu, and their parliamentary structure, the Knesset, is now and has been for some decades in Jerusalem. So they're playing it like Jerusalem is the capital, and often boast about how Jerusalem is the now and forever, as they will tell you, the now and forever permanent, undivided, supposedly undivided capital of the Jewish state of Israel. They brag about that, and they declare it, because that's what they want it to be. They don't tell you about how the many, many ways in which Jerusalem is still severely in an apartheid, very apartheid fashion, divided between Jew and Arab, between Jew and Muslim, and between Jew and Christian. They don't tell you about that. But again, not wanting to get bogged down in that, boycott, divestment, and sanction of Israel academic and cultural life, is a way of forcing the issue on the Israelis that they need to begin to afford the exercise, true exercise of human, political, and civil rights among its native Palestinian Arab population, and essentially quit pissing on them. That's the purpose of the BDS movement. When it comes right down to it, money is the big handle, the big stick, the thing that makes the society and the world go. So BDS clearly is aiming at the money angle. We have to hit him in the pocketbook in order to make this work for everybody. Ultimately, and hopefully on a continuous basis, starting from yesterday, we want everyone, all Israelis and all Palestinians and all other Arabs, to be free and independent and equally, in true parity, exercise their democratic rights. Okay, what's the latest on the BDS front here? From the U.S. campaign to end the occupation, We work to end U.S. support for Israel's 47-year occupation of the Palestinian West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. We uphold equal rights for all. That's the subheading here, the subtitle of the U.S. campaign to end the occupation. They sent this to me a couple of days ago. Will you help make this the biggest month in U.S. divestment history? Obviously, they want me to, among other things, donate more money. But the U.S. campaign also offers a variety of opportunities to sign petitions, to make phone calls, to organize locally in your locale. They provide packets of action, positive action, information kits, that kind of thing. But here's what it is. Here, dear Lawrence, and this really is major, folks. Huge news. Bloomberg News has confirmed that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has divested all $184 million U.S. dollars of its holdings in G4S following an international Palestinian-led campaign, and I reiterate, a nonviolent, totally nonviolent campaign urging the foundation to end investments in the British private security company that helps run Israeli prisons that hold and torture Palestinian prisoners. Let me read all that again so you know, to press upon you what is going on. Bloomberg News has confirmed that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, you know, the Bill Gates of Microsoft, the foundation has divested all $184 million of its holdings in G4S following an international Palestinian-led campaign urging that foundation to end investments in the British private security company that helps run Israeli prisons that hold and torture Palestinian prisoners. In the United States, G4S also operates privatized juvenile detention facilities and works with Homeland Security to detain and deport people across the U.S.-Mexico border and transport immigrants to detention facilities nationwide. Just to give you a slightly broader handle on what all this G4S does, forgive me for not telling you right away what G4S stands for. There is a distinct logo down here. The logo G4S, and it looks like the campaign has inserted the phrase securing injustice. Securing injustice. On the heels of Gates' divestment, public pressure from well-known leaders and activist disruption of the company's annual shareholder meeting, G4S announced that it intends to pull out of Israeli prisons completely. Until it does, the campaigns targeting G4S must and will continue. But this welcome announcement shows the incredible power of divestment and international pressure. So they're actually admitting that their pro-Palestinian, pro-justice activists have disrupted companies' annual shareholder meetings. What that generally means is that they crowded the floors of the annual shareholder meeting place and refused to relinquish the floor when they wanted to talk about the importance of the Gates company, of G4S specifically, divesting. Okay. I hope you're all following me closely. It's not that hard to understand what I'm talking about. Congratulations to everyone involved in the campaign, including the thousands of you who signed this petition, and U.S. campaign member groups in Seattle and Washington, D.C., who delivered it to the Gates Foundation. Your voices were heard. Now, will you be part of another huge divestment moment? Listen to this one. In less than a week, the writer of this piece here, who is Anna Balzer, the national organizer of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. In less than a week, I, Anna, will be on the ground in Detroit, Michigan, where the Presbyterian Church for the USA is considering multiple resolutions in support of Palestinian human rights, including a resolution to divest from three U.S. companies involved in the Israeli occupation. We have heard about the Presbyterian Church before. There is certainly a lot of movement there. And clearly, supporters of Palestinian rights are focusing in on that little whirlpool of activity with the Presbyterian Church in order to accomplish this. Working around the clock, we have been organizing a massive support effort with dozens of member groups and individuals in Detroit and beyond to show Presbyterians that widespread support lies behind them as they follow their conscience and church process by supporting Palestinian rights, from coordinating volunteers to testifying before voting commissioners. And everything in between, the U.S. campaign will be there every step of the way. In Detroit, Michigan. But this is a massive effort requiring a huge amount of time and resources. Only you can make it come together. Together with the G4S victory, this month could go down in U.S. divestment history forever. Referring, of course, to U.S. divestment and U.S. citizens and churches and organizations' divestment from Israel. Certainly from Israel's occupation of the Palestinians, and she asked for a lot of money. With excitement and anticipation, Anna Balzer, national organizer. All right, a national organizer. Postscript. You may remember that in 2012, Presbyterian divestment lost by just one vote. This was some 2 years ago, showing we are at a true turning point where every little action can make a difference. Even if you can't give, you can still sign up to help with social media, graphic design, attending the GA, and more. PPS, you can also contribute by sharing this announcement instantly on Twitter and Facebook. Now, if you want to find out more about this particular campaign of the U.S. campaign to end the occupation, or end the occupation in more general terms, just Google. It's funny, their logo doesn't look quite. Yeah, Google U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. That is the full official name of the organization and the effort. U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. It'll take you pretty much right to it. You go there and you will find all the details on this most recent piece of news about BDS. Okay. You heard me mention talking about boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel and their academic institutions and certain aspects of their culture and their economic life. Specifically talking about how it pertains to academia. Here's something which I think has roughly to do with that. Boston subway ads are shocking, quote, and so is the reality on the ground, by Annie Robbins. This is June 8th of this year. Ooh. They're automatically bringing me way down halfway through the comments. Okay, Mondovice. This appears on the internet's Mondovice. Philip Weiss's e-zine. Mondovice, the war of ideas in the Middle East. Boston subway ads are shocking, and so is the reality on the ground, is the title of this article by Annie Robbins, June 8th. a picture of full-color ads, three in a row, standing on the subway platform and looking across to the far wall. Homeless, stolen, violence, in reference to what Israel is doing to the Palestinians of Palestine, and to some degree even to those Arabs who live in Israel itself. Here's Annie Robbins' article. Bostonians have been checking out the, quote, one-word campaign in their subway system describing Israel's crimes against Palestinians. The ad campaign was launched this week by Ads Against Apartheid, AAA, a local Boston-based nonprofit. And there are, indeed, now I can clearly see the wording on two of those three signs that I was seeing a picture of. Big red letters. Stolen. Overlaid over a portion of what obviously is a Jewish-only illegal settlement in illegally occupied Palestine. Stolen. It says, Israel has built 150 Jewish-only cities. Not apartments, not units, but 150 Jewish-only cities inside Palestine, which is to say occupied territory, recognized globally as illegally occupied territory, using U.S. tax dollars. Does Israel want peace or land? And then the logo in the corner here, Ads Against Apartheid. Article continues, the ads are currently running in Boston's downtown State Street station, where they can be seen by upwards of 13,000 riders per day. AAA's Ads Against Apartheid website states they are, quote, challenging Israel's commitment to peace, end quote. Another picture of a little Arab girl. Impose on the picture, in capital letters, violence. Since September 2000, Israel's military has killed one Palestinian child every 4 days using U.S. tax dollars. I'll repeat the statistic. Since September in the year 2000, Israel's military has killed one Palestinian child every 4 days using U.S. tax dollars and U.S. support for Israeli apartheid. Going on with Ms. Robbins' article here, the ads have already made headlines in Palestine and Israel, that is. Let me repeat that sentence and hope that you catch the important gist of it. Those ads have already made headlines in Palestine and Israel, that is. In other words, not so much in the United States or Canada. She says, both WAFA ads against apartheid launches sometimes they kind of intermix the text of the articles with links, and it's confusing. Both WAFA ads against apartheid launches campaign questioning Israelis' commitment to peace, and Ynet, MBTA, approves pro-Palestinian ads in Boston subway, quote, Chatty Salamoun, the president of Ads Against Apartheid, and Richard Colbath Hess, the NGO's co-founder. Here are the quotes, or quote. Quote, the ads simply state the facts and are backed up with citations from credible human rights and international organizations, including the United Nations, said Chatty Salamoun, the president of Ads Against Apartheid, who added that, quote, if the ads are shocking, that's because the reality on the ground is shocking, end quote. And Richard Colbath Hess, a Jewish-American faculty member at the University of Massachusetts and the co-founder of Ads Against Apartheid, noted that, quote, American tax dollars help the Israeli government maintain an incredibly brutal military occupation, which has denied the Palestinian people their basic rights for decades. These ads show what Israel's occupation and apartheid really look like, and it is important for Americans to see that, end quote. Article continues, Colbath Hess told me that the ads featuring one word per ad, homeless, violence, and stolen, each represent an aspect of Israel's, quote, unrelenting injustice towards Palestinians. IMHO, the one-word approach is in your face. In your face, educational, and very effective. Here is the details of the ad featuring the word homeless imposed on a picture of an Israeli caterpillarish treaded what do you call those machines? The big diggers, the now the word escapes me. They're machines clawing away at the homes of Palestinians, usually to make way for current expansion of Jewish-only settlements. Homeless. Israel has destroyed 25,000 Palestinian homes and created thousands of homeless families using U.S. tax dollars. Does Israel want peace or land? Article continues. Ads Against Apartheid is planning to expand the campaign to other cities all across America. The campaign has other hard-hitting ads up on their website, too, instructing readers to stop talking, start acting, and support spreading the campaigns. Here's one featuring that pillar of Israeli zealotry, Naftali Bennett, from AAA's Peace or Land series. It's an ad with Mr. Bennett's beaming, smiling face, and quotation here from him, quote, I never hide the fact that I categorically oppose a Palestinian state. That's Israel's Minister of Industry, Naftali Bennett. I never hide the fact that I categorically oppose a Palestinian state, major leader in the Israeli government, and by no means the only one who says that or admits that. This is one from their Palestinian Children series. Little boy staring at the handcuffs that encompass his wrists, 9 years old, the age of Palestinian children in Israeli prisons. Is this democracy? And to be honest, I do not know if that is the minimum age of Israeli children in Israeli jails or an average age. I tend to believe it is the youngest, although there could be even younger. Ms. Robbins ends this article about the AAA ads with one word, impressive. Impressive. Annie Robbins, the author, is editor-at-large for Mondo Weiss, a mother, a human rights activist, and a ceramic artist. She lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. Follow her on Twitter at Annie Fofani. That's AnnieFofani. Twitter at Annie Fofani or at Annie Fofani. People who do Twitter, you call that at symbol. You just say at, right? Annie, at Annie Fofani or at such and such. I presume that's how it works. Obviously, I don't Twitter a lot. 89 comments. Justice Will Pray says, excellent, to the point, factual, and informative, in a way which will shock MSM-fed citizens for the better. Wait for the mega whining and smearing to start up. Wait for the mega whining and smearing to start up. Referring to people who support Israel who are going to freak out and think that they have to do something to stop this. Yeah. Justice Will Prevail continues here. Slowly, awareness of the reality of Israel's occupation is spreading. In the United Kingdom, The Observer has a prominent two-page spread on 10 years of breaking the silence with shocking extracts of eyewitness testimonies to the casual killing and humiliation of ordinary Palestinians. And the guy provides link to theguardian.com here. He also, Justice for Palestine, also says, Where is the Kickstarter or Indiegogo crowdsourcing campaign that would enable me to contribute $500 to the expansion of this campaign in an ongoing way to 200 other U.S. and European cities, starting with D.C.? Seriously, will someone please set up such a thing? We could raise millions and really start to change the debate. Kickstarter and Indiegogo crowd. I'll have to make note of those. Hostage says, ditto, go here. AdsAgainstCampaign.com. Author of the article, Annie Robbins, chimes in here. Sorry for not being clear enough. Justice for Palestine, when I wrote, instructing readers to stop talking, start acting, and support spreading the campaigns. You're supposed to open the link. Okay. The Truth Hurts says, wow, surely one of the greatest things I've ever read on Mondo or any site about the Palestine crisis. Now let's get this down to New York City and everywhere else. Pablemont, good enough to make me cry. Hope Bostonians see it that way. Seafoid, very impressive. What a mess they have made for themselves in occupied Palestine. Referring to the Israelis, what a mess the Israelis have made for themselves. The problem they're going to have increasingly in the States is that basically nobody stateside understands IDF Hebrew, Israeli Defense Forces Hebrew, the only language in which all of this is logical. Al Gorir, I love this ad campaign. Great reporting, Annie. Annie shoots back, thank you. Can't take much credit here, though. Ads Against Apartheid makes it very easy. Really smart graphs and messaging. Okay, now we're getting to some of that sloggy stuff that I was referring to. Here's the knee-jerk reaction from those who support Israel. Amigo says, this is the work of the Palestinian, quote, underground, who are all terrorists. Amigo writes here. He says, this is anti-Semitic Jew hatred, just as Israel is making every attempt to make peace with those who seek to destroy the only Jewish state on the planet. We fifth columners will demand that Congress pass legislation outlawing criticism of the only democracy in the Middle East, home of the most moral army and the light onto the nations. Please end these vile and hurtful lies about our beloved Israel. Signed, Desperate Zionist in Denial. Ah, okay. Okay, when I first began reading this, I naturally oriented my thinking towards this is a, as I said, sloggish Zionist knee-jerk reaction to the campaign, to the Ads Against Apartheid campaign. And I was just about to interrupt the reading of this internet article comment by saying, my God, there are still people who think like this. But I think the very last sentence might have given away the fact that this is kind of a false flag entry here. Signed, Desperate Zionist, and then in parentheses, in denial. I think this is someone who probably shouldn't be potentially fooling people like this. Even though there are Zionists and those who love Israel who are in support, who support Israel and who hate any effort to say anything on behalf of Palestinians, who hate any effort towards solidarity with the Palestinians, people do see the Palestinians as nothing but terrorists, ignoring the fact that a great, great many of them are still refugees, not only in the legal sense, but in the actual day-to-day sense. You see, it even confuses me. Refugees, Palestinian refugees who live in camps in squalid conditions. And of course, Israel wants you to believe that's all the fault of the Arab nations who will not take them in. Israel won't take them back either because they drove them out to begin with. That was the whole idea. That's what Zionism is all about. As the guy says here, this is anti-Semitic Jew hatred. We are hearing that expression more and more. I'm coming across it. Anti-Semitic Jew hatred. And when you say Jew in that context, cram it up against the word hatred, it sounds, and is supposed to sound, really dirty, really anti-Semitic, even though it is the Israelis who are utilizing that phrase in order to sort of flick the noses of everyone who even tends to side with the Palestinians on this. Remember, folks, siding with the Palestinians ultimately is and must be siding with every last Israeli as well. We can never forget that everything involved with the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, whether you're talking about the actual organization, ISM, or the general concept, justice must apply to everyone. Real justice actuated peace in the lives of both these peoples. Ultimately, to the lives of all the Arabs living in all the other Arab countries, where things are not so cool either. Everyone must be involved in this. And this, to repeat the sentence here, this quasi-jerk, this is anti-Semitic Jew hatred, just as Israel is making every attempt to make peace with those who seek to destroy the only Jewish state on the planet. There are people, really are people, who believe this, which utterly flies in the face of the fact that Israel is sabotaging peace efforts by refusing to stop the building of Jewish settlements on land that they sold, an expansion of existing settlements, destroying, literally destroying, bulldozing, wrecking, and in some cases exploding portions of towns and villages that are whose residents are not Jewish people, they're Arabs, on land that they stole in 67. Over 25,000 homes destroyed since 1967. This is part and parcel. This goes on literally every week, if not every day of some of those weeks in the West Bank. Yeah, like Israel is making every attempt to make peace, and they do this by absolutely frustrating, disenfranchising, and driving the Palestinian people into a wall against the borders. They want them to leave so they can have all of historic Palestine. I can see what tempts this amigo person to say this. If he really is a false flag, more or less supporter of the Palestinian cause, and he is entering this letter in parody, I can see what tempts him to write this. A person who really believes each of these things could easily have written this letter. They really believe that Israel is making every attempt to make peace with the Palestinians. And while he's charging the Palestinian Arabs of trying to destroy the only Jewish state on the planet, the Jewish state, only Jewish state on the planet, is destroying the culture, the possessions, the property, and literally the lives of Palestinians. The security wall that they put up and completed a few years ago, it was a long time in the planning and the conceptualization. Their security wall is indeed the apartheid wall, which admittedly does a great deal to prevent suicide bombings and bombers from coming across the Green Line into the State of Israel. But it's not saving the lives of Palestinians. It's actually worse. More Palestinians are losing their lives despite this security wall, the apartheid wall that Israel has erected. We fifth columners will demand that the Congress pass legislation outlawing criticism of the only democracy in the ME. Guess what, folks? He's talking about the U.S., obviously. This has happened in Canada. Before the show is over, I'll see if I can dig up that article. It's a long, long, very involved one, but it's not just the U.S. who is in Israel's pocket and who keeps the U.S. Congress in their pocket. It's Canada, too. Signed, desperate Zionist in denial. Even if it wasn't false flag, the guy could be parodying people who are parodying him. Who knows? But someone who calls themselves Mahane Yehude 1 chimes back at Amigo, quoting him, "Please end these vile and hurtful lies about our beloved Yisrael." And Mahane Yehude 1 says, "Correct." So even a false flag parodistical, as in parody entry on these internet comments, draws more of the same, like S attracts flies. But then PJ Dude says, "Jonathan Swift, Jude, Jonathan Swift, clearly satire." So people, other members on this board are taking sides here. Is it real or is it satire? Xenitude says, "Hook, line, and sinker, ha, Mahane, you Zionist are a ridiculously predictable lot." Okay, let's go and see if we can, first of all, take a break from this stuff. Have a little, listen to a little more Stuart Davis. And I'll see if I can dig up that piece about Canadian legislation protecting the holy name of Israel, as it were. You can call in during the musical break. We will not interrupt the music. I'll just answer you directly here on the phone. But you can call in area code 831-427-3772. That's area 831-427-3772.
Goodness in my heart, this evil in my head, do not exist in equal parts, for only one is fed. A growing dark veneer, a conscience in repose. Tonight as I was sleeping here, both of them arose. I saw a demon stare into my face, and an angel touch my breast. Each one softly called my name. The demon scared me less. The demon scared me. Tries to guide and occupies my soul, but I never let it override the mind that I control. If I turn toward the light, its beauty cannot last, for I think that it must be destroyed when I see how we contrast. This wickedness in my reflection is familiar to my eyes. It's the image of this love before. Oh,
less than they stole. They packed my head and they drained my soul. So I learned to sleep in a distant stare out beyond, unaware of a clear internal path I take. And I close my eyes and fall away. Graceful flight, just one push and I learned to fall into the arms of the energy that voiced my call. Now each dream is an epitome, a beautiful glimpse in my permanent home. I'm a timeless entity cloaked in skin, the eye of the universe turning in. And it's all between my ears, I know my way to a magic sphere. Fall away. It's a world to dance with material toys, signals laced with a lot of white noise. There's a place in me scientists can't explain, so they just dismiss.
Okay, we're back. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM, and we stream live at freakradio.org. Click on the red oval for the streaming link. Click on that red oval on top of the little cute little cartoon radio transmitter tower there on the main page. Gotta scroll down to find that. Okay. Yes, I most definitely found the article, which very interesting. Oh, this is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren, R-E-N, Ren, short for Lawrence. Mideast Migraines, by the way, comes to you every Monday at 1500 hours Pacific Daylight Time. That's 3 o'clock p.m., 3 in the afternoon every Monday for about a couple of hours worth. And we are followed at 4:55 Pacific Time by Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. Mideast Migraines, my program, also has a separately produced and recorded separately produced show separately from the Monday show. Also on its other weekend time slot, Saturday, 11 a.m. Mideast Migraines, Saturday, 11 o'clock in the morning, 1100 hours. I use the Saturday edition to read to you important books, whole books, about the Israel-Palestine situation and what each of those parties is doing. I'm currently reading a book which is about 30 years old, but has been updated, and I'm reading from the third edition. Written by former Illinois Congressman Paul Findlay, it is entitled, They Dare to Speak Out, People and Institution Confront Israel's Lobby, referring to the Israel Nation's lobby in Washington, D.C., to get what they want from the U.S. taxpayer. They Dare to Speak Out, I'll be beginning Chapter 4 this Saturday, which is June 14th. You can help me celebrate my birthday the day before by tuning in and listening. I prefer not to take phone calls during the actual reading of the book, but if you still want to call in today, the phone number is area code 831-427-3772. Okay, now, I made reference to what's going on in the Canadian government in terms of how they deal with or allow the Israelis to deal with them. The title of this piece here is essentially the same as an article that I dug up about 10 years ago from a guy named Paul Craig Roberts, former Reagan administration assistant secretary of the Treasury, if I recall correctly. Paul Craig Roberts wrote an article, a much shorter article, entitled Criminalizing Criticism of Israel, and he was referring to how it's done in the United States. This writer, Michael Kiefer, from Global Research, calls this Criminalizing Criticism of Israel in Canada, with this little subtitle here, Bill C-13, a, quote, digital Trojan horse for the surveillance state, by Michael Kiefer, Global Research, April 2nd. And there's a interesting piece of art here showing the Israeli flag swirling above the maple leaf banner of the Dominion of Canada, Canada's flag, almost as though the Israeli flag is swallowing up the maple leaf white and red national flag here. The international campaign calling for boycott, divestment and sanctions, or BDS, against Israel as a peaceful means of persuading that state to abandon its systematic violations of international law and its policies of apartheid dispossession, colonialism, or colonization, and blockade in the occupied Palestinian territories has recently enjoyed a burgeoning number of successes. That is, BDS has enjoyed a number of successes. In early February of this year, The Economist, the magazine The Economist, noted that BDS, quote, is turning mainstream. And former Israeli Knesset Speaker Avraham Berg wrote in Haaretz, which is Israel's most widely read periodical, Avraham Berg wrote in Haaretz that the, quote, BDS movement is gaining momentum and is approaching the turning point at which sanctions against Israel will become a fait accompli, end quote. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made a point of indicating that he and his allies would respond vigorously to this trend. Some of the reports about a cabinet meeting where, quote, tactics were discussed revealed more about internecine divisions than about the substance of the meeting. Quote, Netanyahu convened strategy meeting to fight boycotts, end quote, but he deliberately excluded some senior ministers. Quote, left ministers, or left as in leftist, left ministers kept out of secret cabinet BDS session, end quote. Yet, although Israeli media indicated, quote, that the discussion was held in secret, with an imposed media blackout, end quote, one source that reported this fact was able to give a fairly precise sense of what went on behind closed doors. And there's a colon here. Here is that fairly precise sense. Ideas apparently discussed by senior ministers included lawsuits, quote, in European and North American courts against pro-BDS organizations, and, quote, legal action against financial institutions that boycott settlements and complicit Israeli companies. Referring, of course, to the Jewish-only settlements in the stolen Palestinian land. Legal action against financial institutions, like banks, that boycott settlements and complicit Israeli companies. End quote. There is also the possibility of, quote, encouraging anti-boycott legislation in friendly capitals around the world, such as Washington, Ottawa, Canada, and Canberra, the capital of Australia, and, quote, activating the pro-Israel lobby in the U.S., end quote, for such a purpose. This kind of lawfare, as it is sometimes called, is nothing new, nor, one can add, is the notion, also discussed at this meeting, of bolstering surveillance of pro-BDS organizations by military intelligence, the Shin Bet Security Service, and the Mossad. It's also evidence that the pro-Israel lobby has been active in mobilizing politicians in the, quote, friendly capitals, end quote, of Washington, Ottawa, and Canberra for many years. Recent fruits of that labor have included, in Canberra, threats made in June 2013 by Julie Bishop, a senior member of Julia Gillard's incoming Australian government, that, quote, supporters of an academic boycott of Israel would have their, quote, access to public research funds summarily cut off. In Washington, a bipartisan, quote, Protect Academic Freedom Act that would deny federal funding to colleges and universities that participate in a boycott of Israeli academic institutions or scholars has been brought before Congress. But what of Canada, whose prime minister is Mr. Netanyahu's most faithful friend? By the way, there are very extensive footnotes in this article. Continuing, this essay will argue that revisions to the Canadian Criminal Code proposed by the Harper government, Prime Minister Harper of Canada, contain wording that is designed to enable lawfare prosecutions of human rights activists in precisely the manner desired by Mr. Netanyahu and his associates. Now, here are details. And again, folks, this is an extremely long article. I don't know if I'll be able to finish it, but I may as well dedicate the second half of this episode of Mideast Migraines to delving into the details. Not that there are going to be any final tests or pop quizzes on this, but just to give you an idea of what the Israelis and their government and their foreign ministry are capable of, or at least capable of thinking and attempting. Okay. Again, as what's the man's name? The author Michael Kiefer refers to this, to his essay. His essay will argue that revisions to the Canadian Criminal Code proposed by the Harper government containing wording that is designed to enable lawfare prosecutions of human rights activists in precisely the manner desired by Mr. Netanyahu and his associates. Here is how he lays it out. Number one, Bill C-13 and its deceptions. Bill C-13, the Protecting Canadians from Online Crime Act, as it's referred to, received first reading in the House of Commons in November 2013 in a webpage devoted to, quote, myths and facts about this bill. The Department of Justice rejects the, quote, myth that Bill C-13 is an omnibus crime bill that deals with more than cyberbullying, end quote. Bill C-13 is not an omnibus crime bill. It combines a proposed new offense of non-consensual distribution of intimate images to address cyberbullying with judicially authorized tools to help police and prosecutors investigate not only the proposed new offense, but other existing offenses that are committed via the Internet or that involve electronic evidence. And after a slight lapse in wording here, the bill does not contain the former Bill C-30's controversial amendments relating to warrantless access to subscriber information and telecommunications infrastructure modification. However, Dr. Michael Gist, the Canada Research Chair of Internet and E-Commerce Law at the University of Ottawa, has observed that Bill C-13 does indeed retain provisions that permit an increased warrantless access to personal information far beyond what is envisioned by the current criminal code. Criminal lawyer Michael Spratt has denounced the bill as a, quote, digital Trojan horse for the surveillance state. More of Mr. Kiefer's first stating the apparent myths as they're written in the draft of Bill C-13. Okay, most of C-13 has little to do with protecting victims of cyberbullying. This bill would recklessly expand the surveillance powers of the state. It sacrifices personal privacy. It limits or eliminates judicial oversight. It is inconsistent with recent Supreme Court jurisprudence. It's a dangerous bill. The Department of Justice's claim that, quote, Bill C-13 is not an omnibus crime bill is transparently false. As another critic, Terry Wilson, has remarked, despite being promoted, quote, as legislation to prevent online bullying, the bill actually has very little to do with bullies and has sections ranging from stealing cable, hacking, surveillance, to terrorism. Noting here that cyberbullying accounts for 2 out of the 50 pages in the bill. The bill even includes hate legislation of a sort, end quote. In this latter respect, Bill C-13 incorporates, once again, a Trojan horse. The bill adds wording to the hate propaganda sections of the criminal code that seems, on the face of it, to do no more than to bring these sections into conformity with other parallel texts, with several important documents of international law, and with a sentencing provision later in the criminal code where the same wording already appears. But a second intention is also arguably at work in this part of Bill C-13, for there is good reason to believe that the new wording is intended, while deceptively avoiding any public debate over the matter, to make it possible to prosecute a human rights discourse and advocacy relating to the oppressive treatment of Palestinians by the State of Israel as hate speech or incitement of hatred. Let me read that to you again. But a second intention is also arguably at work in this part of Bill C-13, for there is good reason to believe that the new wording is intended, while deceptively avoiding any public debate over the matter, to make it possible to prosecute human rights discourse and advocacy relating to the oppressive treatment of Palestinians by the State of Israel as hate speech or incitement of hatred. This view of the intention underlying C-13 is supported by Prime Minister Harper, that's Canadian Prime Minister Harper's speech to the Israeli Knesset on January 20, 2014, which will be discussed later. It can draw support as well from the fact that an identical change to the wording of the French Penal Code made in 2003 by the so-called Leloche Law has permitted the conviction of some 20 French human rights activists for incitement of racial hatred. The results in France have been paradoxical. France is, like Canada, a high contracting party of the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949, whose first article states that, quote, the high contracting parties undertake to respect and to ensure respect for the present, to respect and to ensure respect for the present convention in all circumstances, end quote. The people convicted for incitement of racial hatred under the Leloche Law are participants in a movement that has been consistent in its firm rejection of anti-Semitism and all other forms of racism. Again, the people convicted for incitement, those 20 French peoples convicted for incitement of racial hatred under the Leloche Law are participants in a movement that has been consistent in its firm rejection of anti-Semitism and all other forms of racism. This movement advocates a peaceful exertion of economic pressure with the aim of persuading the Israeli state to end its multiple and systematic violations of international law, including in particular the Fourth Geneva Convention, which Israel has been repeatedly condemned for flouting by UN committees and reports, as well as by independent agencies such as Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. The facts of the matter are thus unambiguous. Namely, in enforcing the LaRouche Law, Francis LaRouche Law, and redefining human rights activists as people guilty of hate crimes, the French state has simultaneously been violating its prior solemn commitment, and I quote, to respect and ensure respect for the Geneva Convention in all circumstances. One of the aims of Bill C-13 appears to be to place Canada in a similar situation of openly violating one of the central instruments of international law. Kiefer's detailed evaluation point number two. Alterations to the meaning of sections 318 and 319 of the Criminal Code. Section 12 of C-13 proposes several small additions within that part of the Criminal Code that carries the subtitle Hate Propaganda. Section 12 reads as follows. 12, subsection 318, 4 of the Act is replaced by the following. 4, in this section, identifiable group means any section of the public distinguished by color, race, religion. And then he puts in, Mr. Kiefer accentuates in bold letters, national or ethnic origin, age, sex, sexual orientation, or mental and physical disability. The emphasis here indicates the wording being added to the current criminal code by Bill B-13. He meant C-13. These proposed additions within Section 318 of the Criminal Code, which is concerned with the crime of, quote, advocating genocide, also have an impact on the meaning and application of Section 319, which is concerned with the crimes of, quote, public incitement of hatred and, quote, willful promotion of hatred, and which and in which, as subsection 319.7 states, identifiable group is the same meaning as in section 318. The relevant clauses in section 319 read as follows. And again, folks, remember, no pop quizzes. Just don't try to memorize all this stuff. Just get the gist of where Mr. Kiefer is going with his evaluation of this proposed Canadian law and how he compares it to previous laws to be amended and to other things. Okay, the relevant clauses in Section 319 read as follows. 1. Everyone who, by communicating statements in any public place, incites hatred against any identifiable group, where such incitement is likely to lead to a breach of the peace, is guilty of A. an indictable offense and is liable to imprisonment for a term not exceeding 2 years, or B. an offense punishable on summary conviction. 2. Everyone who, by communicating statements other than in private conversation, willfully promotes hatred against any identifiable group is guilty of A. an indictable offense and is liable to imprisonment for a term not exceeding 2 years, or B. an offense punishable on summary conviction. Mr. Kiefer continues with this article from Global Research. The most noteworthy addition to the concept of, quote, identifiable group is that of the category of national origin, which has no evident connection to the ostensible purpose of Bill C-13, but may be understood as linked to another agenda that was forcefully enunciated by Prime Minister Stephen Harper in his January 20 speech to the Israeli Knesset, namely that of redefining criticism of the policies and behavior of the nation-state of Israel in relation to its Palestinian citizens and to the inhabitants of the occupied Palestinian territories as hate propaganda. As a February 2014 report in the leading Israeli newspaper Haaretz indicated, the hate crime convictions in France several months previously of 12 human rights activists, supporters of the international campaign advocating advocating boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS against Israel were secured under the LaRouche Law, which, and I quote, extended the definition of discrimination beyond the expected parameters of race, religion, and sexual orientation to include members of national groups. Kiefer's investigative analysis, point number three, the LaRouche Law, another Trojan horse. Whether intentionally or not, the LaRouche Law has functioned as a kind of Trojan horse. Dr. Jean-Yves Camus has remarked with this law, that this law, quote, passed on 3 February 2003 in the wake of an unprecedented wave of anti-Semitic violence, allows judges to impose harsher sanctions upon perpetrators of racist violence than those who would normally receive, than those they would normally receive in the case of a similar act of violence not motivated by racism. As the Haaretz report on the criminalization of BDS activism in France indicates, the law's ostensible purpose, at a time when the openly anti-Semitic, anti-immigrant, and neo-fascist Front National of Jean-Marie Le Pen had been attracting increased support in southern France especially, was, quote, to strengthen French Republican values and counter sectarian tendencies, end quote. The law was passed in 2003, shortly after unprecedented gains by the far-right National Front Party, Le Pen's party, in the presidential election. The measure was designed to respond to a social climate of not only mounting anti-Semitism, but also anti-Arab discrimination and xenophobia. The outline of motives that prefaced the LaRouche Law when it was presented to the Assemblée Nationale in November 2002 was explicit in its repeated statements that the additions to the penal code proposed by this law were primarily intended to target openly racist violence. And it's, he spells it out here in French. Violences overtrement racistes, actes de violence internationalmente racistes, violences à caractère raciste, agressions à caractère raciste. It's part of the article, so I had to attempt my crude French pronunciation in reading that. Continuing with the article. Although this text specified that racist violence could be, quote, moral as well as physical, the two recent examples it offered to the deputies of the Assemblée Nationale were the, quote, openly racist murder of a young Frenchman of Moroccan origin in northern France in October 2002, the racist aggression directed against young private students, and racist aggression directed against young students of a private Jewish school in the 13th arrondissement of Paris, in early November, noting that existing French laws already targeted racial discrimination, the incitement of hatred or violence, and Holocaust revisionism. The prefatory outline defined the purpose of this law as being to significantly enhance the penalties imposed in cases where attacks on people or property are racist in character, as when racism is involved in acts of torture and barbarism. A violence resulting unintentionally in death and acts leading to mutilation or permanent disability, as well as acts involving damage to or the destruction of property. Despite this explicit statement of intention, the LaRouche Law has been applied in another manner altogether, on the pretext that in 8 of its 9 articles, it includes the category of nation in the definition of groups that can be understood as victimized. As the Haaretz report indicates, this law, and I quote here, has been invoked repeatedly against anti-Israel activists. France has seen 10 trials against BDS supporters based on LaRouche, end quote. I'm going to grab some cool drink here, rapidly warming refrigerated drink. And once again, soothe my increasingly stressed vocal cords with a throat spray. After doing that, minty. I think that's a mint flavoring anyway. Okay. Continuing with this article by Mr. Michael Kiefer in Global Research. I'm looking for where I left off. Here we go. Pascal Margowitz, head of the BDS legal task force of the Conseil Représentatif d'Institutions Juives de France, the CRIF, is frank in his assessment of the LaRouche law's instrumental value. He's quoted by Haaretz as saying that, quote, the law is the most effective legislation on BDS today. We had only one acquittal, so the statistics are looking good, he said, end quote. But other political figures in France have taken a different view of the matter. Quote, these convictions are unconscionable, Nicole Kiel-Nielsen, a French member of the European Parliament, said at a special session on the case in Strasbourg in 2011. Strasbourg, by the way, is a city in France. Quote, governments are doing nothing to end Israel's illegal occupation of the Palestinian territories, and the French court is wrongfully denying citizens from acting through BDS, end quote. Picture of a Trojan horse here. Rather handsome picture of a wooden Trojan horse. It's important to understand what is meant in the present context by a, quote, Trojan horse. In every version of the ancient story from Homer to Virgil, the essential point is the same. The hollow wooden horse was a duplicitous stratagem used by the Greek army that had for 10 years been besieging Troy. It succeeded because the horse was deceptively dual purpose in nature. Pretending to abandon their siege, the Greeks left this huge artifact behind. Its plausible overt function was as an offering to the gods, which the Trojans were persuaded to drag into their city in celebration of their supposed victory. But it also had a second concealed function, as a treacherous means of getting a body of armed Greeks inside the walls of Troy. In other words, they were hiding in this wooden horse, so that they could open the city gates at night when the rest of their army returned. The LaRouche law has served as a Trojan horse because when it was passed, it seemed an appropriate and plausible means of dealing with an increase in racially motivated violence in France that coincided with an upsurge in support for a frankly racist far-right political party. But the law has since been used for a quite different purpose, that of criminalizing the discourse of human rights activists who speak out in support of respecting and ensuring respect for international humanitarian law. Kiefer's Canadian bill, proposed bill, analysis point number 4, the insertion of the word national into sections 318 and 319. Just house cleaning? According to a report by Paul McLeod of the Halifax Chronicle Herald, The addition of the word national to Sections 318 and 319 of the Criminal Code is explained by the Department of Justice as being, quote, designed to match the wording of a protocol from the Council of Europe, a human rights organization. The reference is to the additional protocol to the Convention of Cybercrime concerning the criminalization of acts of a racist and xenophobic nature committed through computer systems, adopted in Strasbourg in January 2003. In Chapter 1, Article 2.1 of this text, the word national occurs in a definition of the groups understood to be victimized by, quote, racist and xenophobic material. McLeod indicates that some legal experts have proposed that the change is, quote, likely a mere house-cleaning amendment to bring the criminal code in line with the words of other statutes, end quote. The word national does indeed occur in similar contexts in the UN International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, Article 20 and in Article 2 of the UN Convention on Genocide. Moreover, this proposed Canadian Bill C-13 brings those two sections of the criminal code into conformity with the sentencing provision in 718, which already includes all the groups, national origin, age, sex, and mental and physical disability, that were not included in Section 318, but have now been added. A house-cleaning explanation of the changes is thus entirely plausible. However, the house cleaning has not actually been very thorough. In its current form, Section 318 of the Criminal Code, which defines the appropriate punishment for the crime of advocating or promoting genocide, is a somewhat peculiar text, for its subsection 2, while clearly derived from Article 2 of the UN Convention on Genocide, omits clauses B, D, and E of that article's definition. And let's just give the old thinking cap a rest here, and I want to reassure people that, my reading of such lengthy and highly detailed legal stuff is obviously not intended as a form of entertainment for you. But, well, as we all know, it is a way of filling up the roughly 18 minutes left in this program, but I really want to expose people. I choose to read this because I want to expose people, in reiteration here to what I said earlier, the fact that this proposed Canadian law, as is being evaluated by author Michael Kiefer here, is an excellent current example, again reported on back in early April, about 2 months ago, of how Israel is taking advantage of and writing legal provisions and the legislative process of influential foreign nations, in this case Canada and North America, in order to get the critics of Israel and its treatment of the Palestinians off Israel's back. And they're doing this in a truly treacherous way. They are supporting this, what I would consider draconian and highly deceitful proposed legislation. They are engaged in this course of action in order to shield the human rights crimes that they are committing, to shield it from public discourse by making criminals out of the people who were trying to bring up Israel's human rights, hideous and deteriorating, in my opinion, Israel's human rights record. Okay, now let's put that worn-out thinking cap back on and dive back into this. From Michael Kiefer's article. David MacDonald and Graham Hudson have remarked that when Parliament ratified the Convention of Genocide in 1952, it excluded some of the clauses of Article 2 from Canada's criminal code on the grounds that matters such as the forcible removal of children are not relevant to this country. And then parenthetically, given the existence of Canada's system of church-run residential schools into whose custody Native children, Native Indian Canadian children, were forcibly transferred, it seems obvious that the last clause of the convention's Article 2 was excluded in bad faith. Close parentheses. MacDonald and Hudson note as well that when in 2000 Parliament adopted the Crimes Against Humanity and War Crimes Act, it thereby made the 1998 Rome Statute on the International Criminal Court, which includes the Convention on Genocide's full definition of genocide, a part of Canadian statutory law. Section 318 of the Criminal Code is thus anomalous in its current form, in that its definition of the crime of genocide excludes clauses which are nonetheless part of Canadian statutory law because of their incorporation into the Crimes Against Humanity and War Crimes Act. In a thorough house cleaning of this part of the criminal code, the inclusion of the three omitted clauses from Article 2 of the Convention on Genocide would have been an obvious step to take. I mention this not because it tells with any force against a house-cleaning explanation of Bill C-13's insertion of the word national into Sections 318 and 319 of the Criminal Code. As noted above, that explanation remains wholly plausible. But what this example does suggest is that the framers of C-13 may not have been single-mindedly focused on house cleaning. Prime Minister Harper's January 20 address to the Israeli Knesset leads us toward a second explanation of the purpose of C-13's insertion of the word national into the definition of groups that can be victimized by hate propaganda. In suggesting that this speech reveals with some clarity the thinking that underlies this addition to the text of the Criminal Code, I do not mean to imply that the primary or overt explanation of the charge as a house cleaning matter is displaced by this second underlying intention. For that is not how Trojan horses work. Folks, I assure you, I'm roughly where you are on this. I'm trying hard. I not only have the intense duty of reading this word for word properly and not messing up any of the significances or clauses. I'm not only about where you are and trying to... not only do I have to work that carefully in getting this article across to you, but I'm trying to keep up with how it all works, with what he's describing. Let's just see what we come up with. So, again, suggesting that the speech reveals with some clarity the thinking that underlies this addition to the text of the Criminal Code, I do not mean to imply that the primary and overt explanation of the change as a house cleaning matter is displaced by this second underlying intention, for that is not how Trojan horses work. A Trojan horse is by its nature duplicitous, but that duplicity can only be successful to the degree that the horse's overt and primary purpose remains plausible. 5. Kiefer's evaluation, point number 5. Prime Minister Harper's January address to the Israeli Knesset. In this speech, the Prime Minister asked, rhetorically, what it is today that threatens societies that, like Israel, embrace, and I quote here, the ideals of freedom, democracy, and the rule of law? His answer was sweeping, saying the following: those who scorn modernity, who loathe the liberty of others, and who hold the differences of peoples and cultures in contempt. Those who, often begin by hating the Jews, but history shows us end up hating anyone who is not them. Those forces which have threatened the state of Israel every single day of its existence, and which today, as 9/11 graphically showed us, threaten us all. So goes the statement. This might seem imprecise, but as Prime Minister Harper went on to explain, quote, "We live in a world where moral relativism runs rampant," end quote. And the following appears to be an extension of that statement. "And in the garden of such moral relativism, the seeds of much more sinister notions can easily be planted. And so we have witnessed in recent years the mutation of the old disease of anti-Semitism and the emergence of a new strain. We all know about the old anti-Semitism. It was crude and ignorant, and it led to the horrors of the death camps. Of course, in many dark corners, it is still with us. But in much of the Western world, the old hatred has been translated into more sophisticated language for use in polite society. People who would never say they hate or blame the Jews for their own failings or the problems of the world instead declare their hatred of Israel and blame the only Jewish state for the problems of the Middle East. As once Jewish businesses were boycotted, some civil society leaders today call for a boycott of Israel. On some campuses, intellectualized arguments against Israeli policies thinly mask the underlying realities, such as the shunning of Israeli academics and the harassment of Jewish students. Most disgracefully of all, some openly call Israel an apartheid state." Okay, end of that statement. Here chimes in Mr. Kiefer. "In the Prime Minister's view, any profound criticism of Israeli policies and governance can only be a product of anti-Semitic hatred spewed forth by people who are simply looking for further ways of victimizing Jews. By this account, it is very precisely, as members of a national group, as potential or actual citizens of Israel, that Jews are being victimized by these devious, sophisticated new anti-Semites. Canadian Jews could be counted among those victimized in this manner, for those who do not actually hold Israeli citizenship are all potentially Israeli nationals under Israel's law of return." And I note with eager recognition a black and white glossy of Mr. Norman Finkelstein. Kiefer goes on, this claim that criticisms of Israel are motivated by a, quote, "new strain of anti-Semitism and can therefore legitimately be categorized and stigmatized as a form of hate propaganda is not an invention of the Prime Minister. As the historian Norman G. Finkelstein wrote in 2005, the allegation of a new anti-Semitism is neither new nor about anti-Semitism," end quote. "It is rather an ideology formulated in the early 1970s for the explicit purpose of deflecting pressures on the state of Israel to end its occupation of the Palestinian territories of Gaza and the West Bank that had been captured by Israel in the 1967 Six Days War." The following sections will show that the ideology and rhetoric of the new anti-Semitism have been decisively rejected by many contemporary Jewish scholars and public intellectuals, a significant number of whom have come to recognize in the moral debate within the Jewish community over Israel's treatment of the Palestinians a reason for adding their support to the growing international support for the movement of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. This division within the Jewish community provides further grounds for recognizing the Prime Minister's claims as misleading and untrue. It will be shown as well that the judgment that Israel has become an apartheid state, which Mr. Harper regards as the, quote, "most disgraceful of all," has in fact been endorsed by prominent scholars and public figures both in Israel and internationally, including in South Africa, a country whose legal experts and public figures could surely claim with some cause to know better than Mr. Harper what apartheid is. Kiefer's proposed bill analysis, point number 6, refuting the so-called new anti-Semitism. I'll do my best to get through at least this part with only some 5 minutes remaining in the program here. Point number 6, refuting the so-called new anti-Semitism. The new anti-Semitism can be briefly defined as a rhetorical gambit which consists in claiming that the tropes of anti-Semitism, one of whose traditional functions has been and continues to be to justify the exclusion of Jews from the full rights of citizenship in whatever country they inhabit, are now being turned against the, quote, collective Jew as embodied in the State of Israel, with the purpose this time of excluding Jews. He left out a close quote here. I'll just read it straight on. One of whose traditional functions has been and continues to be to justify the exclusion of Jews from the full rights of citizenship in whatever country they inhabit, and are now being turned against the, quote, collective Jew, end quote, is embodied in the State of Israel. With the purpose this time of excluding Jews as a national collective from enjoying their full rights of participation in the family of nations. The aim of this rhetorical turn is to defend Israeli policies and actions by proposing that their critics are only pretending to be acting on the basis of universal principles of justice and equity. These people are instead anti-Semites who, in a sophisticated manner, quote-unquote sophisticated manner, have redirected their hatred against the Jewish nation-state. We can sample the workings of this gambit in three recent instances involving attributions of a redeployment of some of the most vicious traditional tropes of anti-Semitism. The, quote, Jew as embodiment of abjection, filth, and excrement. The, quote, Jew as a contaminating presence or poisoner, parenthetically, most especially if communal water sources, and the, quote, Jew as a child murderer. Over the centuries, anti-Semites have used all of these foul accusations, especially the third, known as the blood libel, the Jew as child murderer, to arouse mob violence and state persecutions of Jewish communities. The first of these tropes was turned against English journalist Johann Hari when he wrote in 2008 that he could not join the celebrations of the 60th year since Israel's founding because of Israel's well-documented mistreatment of Palestinians in the occupied territories, which has included the flushing of untreated sewage from illegal hilltop settlements onto Palestinian farmland, and an embargo on equipment needed to repair Gaza's sewage system, resulting in potentially catastrophic health hazards. Britain's Community Security Trust, parallel in some respects to B'nai B'rith, Canada, accused Hari of, quote, using the themes of Israeli raw, untreated sewage and shit to help explain why he could not bring himself to celebrate 60 years since Israel's creation, end quote. Thus leaving readers to suppose, since no mention was made of Hari's on-site reporting and references to reports on the subject, that he engaged in a literally filthy piece of anti-Semitism aimed at the Jewish collectivity of Israel. Leaving readers to suppose that. The second trope was activated by former Canadian Minister of Justice Erwin Coulter in a paper on human rights and the new anti-Jewishness published by the Jerusalem Post in 2004, in the course of which he declared that, quote, in a world in which human rights has emerged as the new secular religion of our time, the UN portrayal of Israel as the metaphor for a human rights violator is an indictment of Israel as the, quote, new Antichrist, as the, quote, poisoner of the international wells, end quote. Okay, my friends, it's the end of the show. we're actually barely halfway through this article, but I think the information in it, as thick and academic and hard to follow as it is still worthy of this program and worthy of you as an intelligent listener, whoever you may be. Please do not forget, when you hear or have the opportunity to hear either refeeds, reruns of this show on Free Radio Santa Cruz or wherever, I understand now that the particular episodes of this show are being picked up in places like Michigan and who knows where else. You had the opportunity of going to this program's radio archives for episodes of Mideast Migraines. They are located at another website called radioforall.net. That's RADIO, the number 4, the digital number 4, ALL.NET, radioforall.net. Thanks for listening. Join me for the book reading, They Dare to Speak Out, on Saturday, 11 a.m., and of course, I'll return Monday at 3 o'clock. Thank you for tuning in. Now it's time for, we don't have today's issue for some reason, it's not available, of Palestine Today, so I'm going to play for you and push the schedule back slightly on Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm going to play for you This Week in Palestine, which aired last Friday. Thank you for listening to me.